who is a co-author of this work. So I'm very much looking forward to your talk.
Thank you very much. Thank you for being here. The work I'm going to present is joint with Bernard Dumas and Alexander, who's agreed to answer any questions that you might have. So it's a very informal setting, and I'd be very grateful for questions along the way. So we will leave some time for the end if you have questions. But please don't hesitate to raise your hand and ask questions. If I feel I don't want to answer them, then I will exercise my right to postpone the questions to the end. Okay? This paper came about in quite an interesting way. We were all sitting together in the summer 2 years ago, and we were asking ourselves about interesting questions to which there weren't any obvious answers. And so one of the questions we asked ourselves was that if there is excess volatility, as has been documented by many empirical papers, then if there's a hedge fund or there's a smart investor, what should the strategy be for this smart investor to exploit the excess volatility that we see in the data?
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
You said some point, but you mean by excess?
Yes, I'm going to tell you very clearly. Okay. So I'm going to tell you what the literature means and also what we mean by excess. And so we tried to guess what the answer would be, and we tried to verify whether our guess was right. And after a few days of trying different guesses, we realized that we could not guess the answer to this question that seemed fairly interesting to not just us, but a broad range of people. And so we decided to write down a very simple model in which we could answer the question. And very soon the simple model was no longer very simple, because we realized that to really answer all the issues, one had to model this quite carefully. And so about a year and a half later, here I am standing in front of you to tell you what we have done and to describe to you our process of discovery along the way. Essentially, what I'm going to do for you today is start out by defining what we mean by excess volatility, by motivating the talk and telling you what our objective is. And then the heart of my talk is going to be to develop a general equilibrium model where there is excess volatility, and then ask in the context of that model, what should your trading strategy be to exploit that excess volatility. And then I'll show you what the strategy is and what it means for excess volatility in the future. Because if there is a very efficient way to exploit this, perhaps excess volatility should disappear as soon as we start going out and using the trading strategy that I'm going to describe. So those are the three things I want to do. Start with the motivation, describe the model, and end up by telling you what the solution to the model looks like. Okay? Let me also tell you, I'm very keen for feedback. This is the very first time that I'm presenting this paper. And so I have as much to learn about this from you as I hope to tell you from my own work and my experiences with this model. So in the empirical literature, excess volatility is basically defined as the fact that stock prices move a lot compared to what the price actually represents. So stock price is essentially the discounted value today of the future stream of dividends. And in a very nice picture, based on the work of Shiller, what he does is he essentially plots two series. One series is a plot of the stock price. That's the very volatile series. And the other series is of the discounted value of dividends looking back. So you look at realized dividends, you discount them, and you say that if I knew what dividends were going to be, what should the stock price have been? And that's the much less variable, the more or less straight line that you see on the picture. And so this is what the empirical literature calls the excess volatility puzzle, that if dividends actually don't move that much, why do their present value discounted, which we call the stock price, why does the stock price move so much? Okay. And so our objective essentially is to try and understand what you can do if you see this kind of excess volatility. In the model, I'm actually going to have an even stricter definition of excess volatility, and I'll get to that in a few minutes. So essentially, if you see excess volatility, then there must be some informational inefficiency in the market. And so the question is that we want to address is, one, how can we figure out the optimal trading strategy for an investor who understands that volatility is excessive and who wishes to exploit this? And the second question that we want to understand is, what is the implication for the long run presence of excess volatility if all smart investors start using the strategy that they should to exploit excessive volatility? Okay. Can this artifact in the data be driven out, or will it persist for a long period of time? So this essentially is a summary of the questions that we wish to answer. And our contribution is first to construct a model in which there is excess volatility. And so let me give you a description of the model in English, and then we'll come back to the model and talk about it with the mathematical equations. In our model, we are essentially going to have two classes of investors. One class of investors are going to be irrational or overconfident in the following sense. The long-term expected growth rate of dividends is not known, it's unobservable, and there's going to be a signal about this dividend. And the irrational or overconfident investors are going to believe that the signal is actually more informative than it actually is. They're going to believe that the signal is correlated with the dividend growth rate, with the dividends, and so they're going to infer that this signal has more information. They're going to base their decisions on this mistaken view, and as a result, they're going to overreact to the signals that they get because they view the signal as being more informative than it actually is. There's going to be a second class of investors, smart investors, hedge fund players, who fully understand the data, the model. They do not make any mistakes in drawing inferences based on the signal. And so what we want to do is, one, see the excess volatility generated by having these overconfident investors, and two, study what the rational, smart investors would like to do to exploit this excess volatility. So in my model, excess volatility is going to be defined as the volatility that is present because of the existence of overconfident investors, which is a stronger definition than the one in the data, in the empirical work. Okay. The modeling device that I'm going to use to generate excess volatility has already been used in the literature by Shankman and Xiong. It's a very nice paper that all of us liked very much when we read it, and so we wanted to adopt as much of their framework as we could. And so these two classes of investor are exactly how Shankman and Xiong generate excess volatility, but there are going to be some deviations from their model. They have essentially a partial equilibrium setting. Their model is not closed. We're going to have a general equilibrium setting. In their model, investors are risk neutral. It makes solving the model much more easy. My co-authors like to solve difficult models. So we're going to have investors who are risk averse. And in their model, they need to impose short sale constraints, because with risk neutrality, the tendency is to take infinitely long or infinitely short positions, and the way they make the portfolios finite quantities is by imposing short sale constraints. In our model, we are not going to impose short sale constraints. We are going to let risk aversion endogenously determine the magnitude of the position that investors take. Okay, so that gives you a sense of the origins of the model and also how it deviates from what is already in Shankman and Chung. What we're going to do in this model is solve for the general equilibrium, determine the prices of the different securities in the economy, and identify the dynamic trading strategy for the rational investor. Our main conclusion is going to be that if you are a hedge fund and you want to design a trading strategy, then your trading strategy is going to have a few components with a particular objective. As is standard in these models, your portfolio will always have a mean variance component, where essentially you hold that component to take advantage of the excess return relative to the risk on risky assets. So that's called the Markowitz portfolio, the myopic portfolio, the static portfolio, which is standard in all the models. But then this model is going to generate two additional demands in your portfolio. The first one is going to come because you have to infer what the expected growth rate is going to be. And as your beliefs about the future growth rate of dividends vary, you will change how much long or short you wish to be in the stock. Okay. The second additional component is going to be about the dispersion in beliefs between what the rational investors believe and the overconfident irrational investors believe about the world. And so we will describe the portfolio as being composed of a standard mean variance component and some additional components, where the additional components come because of some investors being overconfident and you want to take advantage of their overconfidence today, but you also want to guard against how this level of overconfidence is going to change over time. Okay? And I'll give you more details as we go along into the model. And so in the end, what we'll be able to do is say something about risk arbitrage, where now this is really the appropriate term for defining the portfolio strategy. It is an arbitrage strategy on excess volatility, but one that is risky because you need to guard against how beliefs of agents will change over time. And so you cannot lock in profits for sure. Even if volatility is excessive today, you're not sure whether next period it's going to be smaller or larger. It will change depending on dispersion of beliefs. And so the strategy is going to depend, is going to be focused on both exploiting the excess volatility, but also defending against changes in excess volatility over time. Okay. And the last thing that we'll do is ask ourselves that if we are smart and we can figure out this strategy, how long does it take for us to take all the money away from the overconfident investors? Can we rip them off in a day? If you look at the standard literature with efficient markets, it says that anomalies don't exist for very long. Given the size of the capital of hedge funds, we should see the hedge funds take all the money away from overconfident investors almost instantly. And what we find in our own, in the context of our model, is that even after 200 years, irrational investors are worse off. They've lost half their wealth, but not all of it. So the half life of their wealth is very long, of the order of hundreds of years, which means that even if you and I understand the trading strategy and we execute it, we will not be able to eliminate excess volatility right away. It will persist for a long period of time. And the reason for that is that because you and I are risk averse, because you and I must devise our strategy to protect ourselves against adverse changes in volatility, we will not take extreme arbitrage positions. We will adjust for the risk of this arbitrage. There will be limits to the arbitrage strategy, which will therefore slow down the rate at which we can rip off the overconfident investors. Okay? So that, if you like, is a summary, in without any equation so far, of what I really want to tell you and essentially the rest of the talk is about how to model this and what the precise details are. There are many other models of excess volatility, and the main reason for not choosing these different modeling devices as opposed to the one that we pick is, one, we like Shankman Xiong's model. When we read the paper, we almost wished that we had written that paper. It's a very nice paper and a much easier model to solve than the one that I'm going to describe to you. So we were envious that they had anticipated all the neat tricks in the literature. And these other models have other limitations. I don't want to go into the limitations now, but you can read about them in the manuscript. But essentially, they have some undesirable properties, and so we decided to model things in a slightly different way.
I wonder why it is that you use dividends rather than, say, earnings. Dividends probably are stickier and so on.
In our model, dividends and earnings are going to be the same thing. So whatever a firm makes, it's going to pay out. It's going to be like a Lucas endowment economy, and so there's full payout of the entire dividend. It's a non-storable dividend. Okay. All right. So
regarding the signal, is it public or private?
The signal? The signal is a public signal. So everyone gets the same signal, but I am overconfident. I think it's more informative. You know that the signal doesn't have that much information in it. So you and I update differently. Okay? That's a good question. Okay. All right. So let me give you a sense of the model. My objective here is just to give you enough information so you understand what is driving the results. In the paper, we have very long appendices explaining how exactly things work, but I don't want to get bogged down with a lot of mathematics. Okay? So dividends are modeled as in a Lucas endowment economy, which means essentially delta is the dividends or the earnings, which is falling from the tree at a stochastic with a stochastic output over here. And the stochastic output is the volatility of the dividend is given by sigma delta. It's too bright.
That might work. It's got two strands.
Okay, they're excellent. So the volatility is given by sigma delta, and then there's a growth rate, a drift rate, which we denote by F, and that is not observable. So this is the key unobservable quantity in the model, and what we know is that it has a certain process. There's a mean reverting process. The long-term mean is F bar. Xc is the force which pulls it back towards the mean, and it has a volatility sigma F, and it's driven by a Brownian ZF where we don't observe the Brownian, and so the Brownian has to be the process for F has to be inferred from what we can observe. What we can observe, what helps us back out the value of S is this signal S, which in the long run has the same drift as F, and then the signal comes with some noise, and the volatility of that noise is sigma S. Okay. So in a sense, we're getting two pieces of information. One, we get to observe the dividend itself, and two, we get to observe the signal. We need to put these two things together to figure out what the long-term growth rate is. Now, to do the inference, to figure out what the growth rate is, we need to understand what the beliefs of the agents are. And one set of agents are rational, we'll call them group B. They are fully rational. They know that the signal is not correlated with the process, the fundamental process, and this correlation is therefore is phi equal to zero. No, it's okay. I can reach out. Thank you. Okay. Maybe I will. My chances of growing taller during the talk are minimized now. Okay. Now, all the action in the model is generated by the irrational investors. Irrational investors essentially believe that there is some correlation phi not equal to zero, phi is bigger than zero, between the fundamental process and the signal. And so essentially when they do their updating, their updating process is different. The filters that they, the filtering that they do, A and B, is slightly different. And so these are the filtering equations. The important thing to realize is that the filtering equation of A, so where gamma A is the volatility of this, gamma A basically is going to have a smaller variance. This is the variance. Gamma A is going to be smaller than gamma B, which means that we're going to, if we were irrational, we would assume that our signal is less noisy than it actually is. We think that it's a signal that is more precise than it actually is, which is the reason why Shankman Xiong call these people overconfident. They put too much weight on the signal because they believe that there's a correlation with F, with the process for F, which is actually not there. So, gamma A is the steady state variance of F. In this model, if you really solved it out completely, gamma F would be a deterministic function of time. But what we're going to assume is that enough time has gone by that you've reached the steady state, okay, just like Shankman and Xiong do. And so there is no more updating being done, in particular by the irrational guys. They are not trying to learn the true correlation. They believe in a non-Bayesian irrational way that this correlation phi parameter is actually bigger than zero. Okay, so this is the exact sense in which these investors are irrational. If they were Bayesian investors, they could back out that they believe something which is not true, but they've decided to hold on to their beliefs despite what they see in the data. And this is what generates all the action in the model, in particular, excess volatility. We need to assume something about the financial markets. We are going to assume that financial markets are complete. We need to make this assumption so that we can solve the model with only a reasonable amount of difficulty rather than an extraordinary amount of difficulty. There are going to be two Brownians which are observable, delta, the dividend Brownian, and the signal Brownian. And so you need three risky assets to fully span these two observed Brownians. The natural candidates are, one, the equity on the endowment process, on the dividends, and a short maturity, instantaneously riskless asset. These are the two standard things that any model would have. And the third security we introduce to complete the market is a long maturity bond, which is a claim to a fixed amount of output at some fixed maturity date. So these are going to be the three financial securities. You could have any menu that you wanted as long as you had three independent securities. Okay. With complete markets, the problem becomes a little bit easier. You can essentially use the martingale methods of Cox and Huang, Lihosky, Shreve, and Sethi to write down what the problem of the investor would be in terms of martingales, in terms of expectations. And so the first thing we do is switch from the natural probability space to the probability space of investor B. So we will work in the probability space of investor B. It has no bearing on the results because markets are complete. You could also work under the probability space of investor A or some other probability space. So all the quantities will look the same. And we essentially over here, without going through the equations, we show how you can transform the driving processes for dividends, the signal, and the view about agent A and agent B about the growth rate of dividends, how you can rewrite that in terms of the Brownians for agent B under B's filtration rather than the natural one. Okay? So this tells you how to change the measure going from A to B. And it's pretty, this is very standard. Once you have complete markets, you can figure out what the transformation is to go from one set of measures to another set of measures. The one thing that we need to highlight now is that because the filtering of A and B is being done under a different set of beliefs about the correlation, the filtered values for A and B are going to diverge over time, converge over time, they're going to be stochastic, and the difference between A and B filtered value we're going to denote by G hat, which is the difference between the filtered view of B minus the filtered view of A. Okay, so when G is bigger than 0, then B is optimistic relative to the other group. And also you can see how they react when there's a shock to the signal, because this quantity here is negative, this quantity in the numerator is negative. When there's a positive signal, population B becomes less optimistic, G becomes smaller relative to its past value. Okay, so this is a standard equation from filtering. To solve the model, we need to figure out what the state variables are, and again, there are ways of redefining the state variable choice. Over here, we're going to work with four state variables: delta, which is the underlying fundamental quantity; eta, which is the relative weight of agent A relative to B, so it tells you how A and B are related to each other; fb, which is the filtered view of agent B; and the last one could be fa, the filtered view of A, but we prefer to write it in terms of G, the difference between A and B, and I'll come back and explain to you why. This essentially allows me to have two variables about fundamentals, one variable about the growth rate, and the last one about the dispersion in the growth rate. And so we're going to restate the state variables so that we have essentially four variables that have an obvious, clean interpretation. This matrix over here tells you what the diffusion quantities are, the diffusion matrix, and I will explain this on the next slide. So there are two distinct effects of imperfect learning. The first effect is instantaneous, that G hat has a non-zero diffusion. If phi was equal to zero, if there were no overconfident agents, then the drift of G, the diffusion of G would be zero. There would be no stochastic evolution of G hat. The second effect is cumulative. Because the diffusion of eta depends on G hat, okay, over time, the wealth of population A and B relative to what it was in the past varies, and so this is the cumulative effect as one population gets richer relative to the other one. Okay. So that essentially is all the filtering stuff and how the model is set up, and now we are ready to talk about how our agents are actually going to solve the problem that they face given the environment that they live in. So this is a very standard formulation now, that what agent B wishes to do is maximize the utility of lifetime consumption, where utility is given by a power function and risk aversion is going to be given by 1 minus alpha. The impatience rate is going to be the discount subjective time preference rate is going to be given by rho, and so this is the agent's objective function, and the agent faces a constraint, and the constraint is that the present value of consumption, so xc is the pricing measure, is the risk neutral measure. So when you look at the value of consumption over your lifetime, it should be equal to the value of the stock over your lifetime, adjusted for the number of shares that you started out holding, your initial endowment of the stock at date zero. Okay, so this is a very standard budget equation, a budget constraint, and one of the nice features of our model is that we don't have noise traders, we don't have odd people who are not optimizing fully. So in our setup, our agents are fully intertemporal optimizers with well-defined budget constraints. The only suboptimal thing is in their Bayesian updating. They are not fully updating in the Bayesian way. The problem for agent A is the same. The only thing to note here is that agent A will be working under her own probability space. So the Brownians will be in terms of A. And given that we know how to go from the space of A to the space of B, we can change the measure and we can rewrite the problem of agent A under the measure B, making the standard adjustment for the change in measure in the objective function and then change in measure in the budget equation. So this is all very standard and mechanical, and all I want to do is just tell you that the way we solved it was essentially using the measure of B. We also solved it using the measure of A, just to make sure that we hadn't made any mistakes. But in the paper, we describe everything in terms of the measure of B. So equilibrium is a very standard definition. Equilibrium is defined as that set of processes where investors optimize consumption choices. They make the right portfolio decisions based on what their perceived view is about prices. Security prices are consistent with that perceived view, and markets clear. Okay, so the market clearing for the condition for the stock is that there is one share. So in aggregate, people should be holding only one share. For the long-term bond, the market clearing condition is that there's a zero bond. It's in zero net supply, so the aggregate should be zero. And this is the aggregate clearing condition in commodities. This expression is the consumption of agent A. The consumption of agent B should add up to the total dividends or earnings being paid out in the economy. Okay, so this is a full characterization of equilibrium, and you can get the pricing measure, what it's going to look like. You can get expressions for the optimal consumption of the agents. Over here, the only thing to note is that, as is typical in a single agent economy, the sharing rule, in an economy with two agents but complete markets, the sharing rule is linear in delta, but the slope of the sharing rule is stochastic. It changes with eta, the relative weight of the two agents in the economy. Okay, so we can solve these equations to characterize equilibrium fully. And then the only things that are left to be determined are lambda A and lambda B. These are the Lagrange multipliers on the budget constraint of the two agents. And to get these, you essentially need to make sure that the initial wealth of the agents matches what the consumption share of the agents is over their lifetime. Okay? And so I've just restated the state variables over here. And the last set of things I need to show you is that we can solve for the pricing measure in closed form. The pricing measure is characterized by the interest rate and the market price of risk. And this over here gives you the expression for the interest rate in closed form, where you can see it depends upon the growth rate of dividends FB. It depends upon the dispersion, the difference between the view of A and B. And it depends on the dispersion, the squared gap between the view of A and B about future dividends. Okay, so the first few terms are very standard from, say, a Cox, Ingersoll, Ross or a Lucas model. And these terms show up because there are two sets of agents with different beliefs. Okay, you can also solve for the market price of risk in closed form. And you can see that if there is no disagreement, if G hat is equal to zero, this term and this term drop out, and then there is zero reward for signal risk. So this is the second market price of risk is zero. You compensated only for aggregate dividend risk. But once you have disagreement about the future growth rate, then the market price of risk has to reflect the fact that we will disagree about the future, and so we need to be compensated for the changes in the views of the two investors. Okay. To get the stock price, the bond price, the wealth, any price that you want in this economy, it's a very easy, straightforward calculation in the first step, where over here essentially the price of the stock, which we denote by F, to say that this is a financial asset, the financial price, the financial wealth of the aggregate economy. The stock price is essentially in a conditional expectation of the payoff of this security, the dividends, adjusted by the pricing measure in the future relative to today. So this is a marginal rate of substitution, or the ratio of marginal utilities, and this expectation is difficult to evaluate in closed form, but what you can do is get an expression for the characteristic function in closed form. Okay, the wealth of population B you can evaluate the same way, where the payoff is essentially the consumption stream that comes out from this wealth. Okay, so you can interpret consumption as the dividend paid out by the wealth that you're holding. Okay, so the joint distribution of these variables delta and eta are difficult to obtain, but what you can do is write down the characteristic function in closed form, and in the appendix we provide these expressions, and this is what we use for doing all the numerical work for the computations that I'm going to show to you on the next few slides. So we are ready now, after all this hard work, to see what comes out of the model. It took us about a year to solve the model. We first solved a very simple version of the model where some agents, the rational agents, had negligible weight, where the hedge funds were very small relative to all the irrational investors in the real world. But then my co-authors are always pushing, so once we solved that model, they wanted to solve the full general equilibrium model. And we have a solution now, so let me tell you what it looks like. All the pictures that I'm going to show to you are going to have two lines on them. There's going to be a red dotted line, which represents the case where everyone is fully rational. And then there's going to be a blue dashed line, which will represent the case that we are interested in, where some agents are overconfident, where they believe phi is equal to 0.95. We use parameter values from an estimation exercise undertaken for a similar model by Brennan and Shia. So the values that you see have not been estimated by us, but they're very reasonable and in line. It doesn't really matter, like it doesn't have a big effect. If it's not zero, you can get the action. And so we basically picked one that to get the biggest effect in the picture so you can see what's going on. Okay. So all the values are from Brennan and Shia, except for this one, where we need to have some noise in the signal, and we just assign a volatility of 10%, and then the parameters for the agents, we essentially pick very innocuous values. We've looked around and seen that our results are not sensitive to the choice of parameter values. We assume that each agent is equal, so the two populations have equal initial wealth. The risk aversion of the two agents is 3 when they start out. And the only parameter that's a little bit larger than what one would like to assume is the subjective time preference parameter. In macro, they typically use 2 or 3%. We've had to use 11% to make sure that the solution exists. There's a transversality condition for the integrals to be bounded. And for that, rho has to be big enough. Discounting has to be fast enough. And so we picked a rho of 11%. Okay. One last detail before I start showing you the results. Instead of working with FB, I translate FB into, instead of working with the belief of B, I translate it into the average belief in the economy, where this average is relevant only for very short maturities. And the advantage of replacing F of B with F of M is that we can get a clean interpretation where this now represents just the view about the average, and G hat now represents the view about the variance or the dispersion about your beliefs. Okay, so there are going to be lots of pictures. I'm not going to talk about each one, but I'm just going to highlight one or two things in all the pictures. So it's going to be difficult for you to see the details on the pictures, and you don't need to see the details. I just need to tell you what's on them so you can get the main message. Firstly, all the plots have four pictures where we draw each quantity against that particular state variable. So there are four state variables, delta, eta, which is the relative share of agent A versus B, which instead of eta we use by plotting how much agent B consumes relative to aggregate dividends, the average belief F of M, and the dispersion in beliefs G of hat. Okay. So the red dotted lines are for the case where phi is equal to zero, everyone is fully rational. Blue is the line where agents are overconfident. And so there are two things that you can take away from all these pictures right away, is that price levels are reduced by the presence of irrational investors. There's a demand for an extra risk premium when there are crazy people in the world, and that's reflected by a drop in all the blue lines relative to the red lines. And the second thing is that the prices decrease as your view about the expected growth rate increases. So this is a counterintuitive result, that if I come and tell you that in the future dividends are going to be higher, you actually value the stock less. And the reason for this is that when future dividends are going to be high, the marginal utility is going to be low. So when you multiply it with the future dividends, the net effect for the risk aversion parameter that we've assumed is negative rather than positive. Okay, all right. You can see what happens to volatility. Irrational agents create noise, and so a result of that noise is that both stock return volatility and bond return volatility go up. The blue lines are above the red dotted lines. The blue lines are the volatility levels when there are overconfident agents. And again, there are four plots for the four state variables. Okay. As a precursor to the survival results, we can also look at what happens to volatility as the relative wealth of B decreases. So over here we have the relative wealth of B. We can see that as the relative wealth of B decreases, volatility goes up, which means as the size of the irrational population increases, stock return volatility goes up, and as the weight of the rational group increases, excess volatility comes down. Okay. All right, so I'm trying to see now which things not to tell you, so we're running out of time here. So, go ahead.
The feedback from the parameters, from the volatility back to the parameters.
Yes. Right. Okay, it's fully general equilibrium. Everyone anticipates everything. The only twist is that B, agents A don't update properly. That's the only thing. Otherwise, it's fully, there's full feedback and everything is reflected in the prices. Okay? All right. So let me show you the total portfolio holdings of population B, the rational agents. How is their portfolio different than in an economy where there were no overconfident agents? So just as before, there are two plots. There's a red dotted line, which is exactly at zero, so it's difficult to, at one, which is difficult to see. There's a red dotted line over here, and then there's a blue dotted line, which tells you the portfolio when there are overconfident agents in the economy. Okay. So let's start with the base case. If everyone was rational, then everyone would hold 100% of stock and they would hold 0% of the bond. Okay, which is, that's a good benchmark that we can all agree on and start with. With irrationality, the holding that you wish in stocks decline. So instead of the red flat line over here, you hold less stock unless you are much, much more optimistic about the future prospects of the dividend process. Okay. The changes in this plot are reflected over here. As your stock holdings decline, you compensate by increasing the bond holdings from the red dotted line here up to the blue dashed line here. And the reason why you compensate is because these two assets are positively correlated. And so you are essentially choosing an optimal portfolio where changes in stock holdings are also reflected in changes in the long maturity bond. To understand why these things are changing in particular ways, we decompose the overall portfolio into small component portfolios, applying the decomposition described in Merton 71. And so essentially, Merton describes portfolios consisting of a static portfolio and hedge portfolios. And over here, I essentially describe what the hedge portfolios are. So there are four state variables. And so I'm going to show you how B's portfolio, what part of it is designed to hedge changes in delta. So under rationality, the hedge against delta risk is zero when G hat is zero. So we are at this point over here. The hedge term changes sign with G hat. So even under rationality, if the priors are different, you will hold slightly different portfolios. But an increase in delta reduces the value of B's wealth, as I told you, as marginal utility changes. And therefore, the hedge portfolio over here is to hold equity negatively to hedge against changes in delta. And this is offset by changing what you do on the bond side by increasing the amount of bonds that you hold so that the stock holdings and the bond holdings net out to some extent. Okay. The other thing that you care about, the next thing, is the average belief. So over here we have a strange looking picture. And the reason why it looks strange is because these quantities are very small. They are close to zero. So it's essentially, this picture should have been flat, but it doesn't look like that because the scale is with very small quantities. The hedge for the average beliefs consists almost entirely of holding in bonds. So these numbers are fairly large. And the reason for that is that the bond, the interest rate, the bond price reflects almost exactly changes in beliefs. And so this is the ideal instrument to hold if you want to take a position in beliefs. So that's one of the things that comes out, is that as a hedge fund, if you're designing a strategy, which instruments to use to take positions based on particular aspects of your view of the world. So if you want to bet on a change in the drift rate, then bonds are the ideal instrument, not stocks. Okay. And the last portfolio that I'm going to show to you is what to do about dispersion in beliefs, represented by G hat. So under rationality, there is no worry about G hat. Under rationality, you essentially have a flat line. The hedge portfolio is zero. But if there is irrationality, then even if you disagree, even if you agree today, when you know that the future is going to evolve differently, you hedge against changes by changing what you hold in equity and changing what you hold in bonds. So the last result that I want to describe to you is about survival. And over here I need to explain to you in words what we are doing. There are many ways of measuring survival, and the measure that we essentially picked was to plot what the relative share of consumption of agent A was going to be relative to the aggregate dividends. And so what I plotted over here is the share of the irrational investors' consumption relative to aggregate dividends in the economy. And on the x-axis, I basically have number of years. So at date zero, I start out my investor with equal wealth, equal to the smart population. And I see that these guys on average are steadily losing money. But even after 200 years, they still have half their wealth. So smart investors are making money off overconfident investors, but not at a rate that is fast enough to impoverish them completely. Okay, and so that means that you can see excess volatility even if people are doing risk arbitrage. It doesn't mean that excess volatility is going to be driven away instantaneously. Okay. A side remark, this plot has to be done not under the measure of B or the measure of A, but this is what actually happens. And so this computation has to be done under the objective measure, under the true measure, rather than the one that is perceived by A or B. Okay. So let me end by summarizing what we have done. We've essentially demonstrated that there is a strategy that allows you to take advantage of excess volatility. It involves taking position not just in stocks and money market, but also a long maturity bond. This is a dynamic trading strategy which changes over time as you change how much protection you want against the craziness of the irrational group. Okay? And so you can't take a position looking just at the current state of the world. You also need a model which tells you how the current state is going to change, what is going to be the speed of convergence over time as both the irrational and rational investors update their view about the state of the world. Okay? So the optimal strategy, not surprisingly, consists of using all three securities, and then a macro result is that agents survive for a long time. They don't disappear in the short run very quickly, as one might expect from a standard rational expectations model.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mahendra. A very nice talk, open talk for this day. So there's still time for questions.
Yes. You've got a bond in there with a 10-year maturity. To what extent does the solution depend on that choice of 10?
It doesn't depend on the choice of 10, but it would depend on the kind of security. So if we had an option, it would be a different portfolio. But the net position would be the same, right? Because an option has stock and bond built into it. So in that sense, it doesn't depend on the menu of securities, but the plots would all be very different depending on the security you had, but it doesn't depend on the maturity of the particular maturity of the bond.
Question? Comment? The conditions on the risk aversion, I missed that at some point, that you have both risk aversions, they were equal.
Yeah, okay, so in this
equation. And that could be more influential, yeah. Or not? Or?
So in this model, we didn't want to have many different things occurring at the same time. So Bernard already has a paper in which he describes what happens when there are two populations with different risk aversion. I can summarize the results. Basically, the less risk averse guys hold more of the stock, the more risk averse guys hold more of the bond, and if the economy is growing, then the less risk averse guys dominate in the long run. Okay. So over here, we wanted to keep the risk aversions the same. It makes solving the model much easier because basically the sharing rule is linear rather than being non-linear. There's a same coefficient on it.
One thing that you could do would be to take different impatience rates for the two groups. As your result shows, it takes a very long time for the irrational people to get squeezed out. A small difference in impatience rates might actually turn the picture around the other way.
Yeah. Okay. So there's a very nice paper by a PhD student at London Business School. His name is Hong Jun Yan, and his paper is exactly about this. He takes the model of Kogan, Ross, Westerfield, and Wang, and where they only have consumption at the maturity date, he adds intermediate consumption and sees that the results depend very much on impatience rates. Small differences in the impatience rate can lead to very large changes in survival probabilities. Okay, so we can definitely do that.
Sure. Thank you. Any further comment or question? If not, then I thank you once again for a very nice
talk
for this day. We have now half an hour coffee break, and we'll resume at 12 o'clock with Anthony Letford. So, Anthony from Man Investment, and not Management Investment. See you back in half an hour. Coffee served outside. Thank you.
I hope it was clear.